Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, today we are going to start our show talking about the inequities and many of the questions that are being raised around school closures across the country. And then later in the show, we will open the lines to take your calls about the virus. We do have a couple of really important updates. California Governor Gavin Newsom says events with over 250 people should be banned through March. And there's a new study out of China that says the virus can live in patients for 5 weeks after contagion. So we will talk with our guest at about 40 after about those issues. But right now we want to talk about what's happening in schools. The cities of San Francisco, secure schools. Many districts across the country are closing schools, and that raises so many questions about things like childcare and access to food. All Seattle schools will be shut down for the next 2 weeks. 22 million students rely on free or reduced lunch, and for many, it is their only hot meal of the day. More than two-thirds of the 31 million students who regularly eat school lunch are economically dependent on that meal, according to Civil Eats. On March 9th, the New York Times ran a piece called Why Closing Public Schools is a Last Resort. And Eliza Shapiro reports that New York City has the largest public school system in the country. It's a vast district with about 750,000 children, and they're poor. And that includes 114,000 who are homeless. Now, for many of these students, school is the only place where they can get three hot meals a day and medical care and even wash their dirty laundry. So joining us to talk about these inequities and what it will take to actually address them is Diane Ravitch. Diane formerly served as Assistant Secretary of Education, and she's out with a new book called Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Hi, Diane. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. It's great to talk with you in this terrible time.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Diane. And you wrote a great book. I don't think we'll have that much time to get into it, but we'd love to have you back once all of this is under control. But I'm really glad we did book you because there's so many questions surrounding all of these school closures.
Yes, and by the way, New York City has 1.1 million students in its public schools, not 750,000. And most of those children are economically disadvantaged and get their only hot meal at school and their only medical care at school if their school has a school nurse. I was just reading about school nurses, and about one out of every six urban schools does not have any school nurse at all. Many of them have part-time coverage. We've cut back on school nurses. I mean, in economically secure districts, parents insist on a school nurse, but we have about 35% of our districts that have either no nurse at all or only someone who comes in once or twice a week.
Wow. I mean, Diane, you're reminding me a lot of these inequities have come up around all of the school strikes, hearing teachers talking about the struggles that they're dealing with in their schools and having two or three jobs. This brings up so many more issues.
Well, this is one of the central themes of the book that we're not talking about today. My book is called Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Danger to America's Public Schools. And I begin by talking about the teacher strikes. And the reason that teachers have been striking all over the country is because of these draconian budget cuts that have been imposed over the past 10 years that have caused so many schools to lay off school nurses and to lay off teachers and to cut the budget to the bone. And California, by the way, is spending below the national average on per pupil on schools. And it's cut its support of public higher education dramatically ever since Ronald Reagan was the governor of California.
Can you elaborate a bit more on that? I mean, for people who don't have kids in school or aren't that familiar with the public school system, you know, to say that so many schools do not have an adequate number of nurses is pretty shocking, especially when you're talking about schools in wealthy areas.
Well, you could start by just saying if you lived in an affluent district, what would you expect there to be? You would expect to have a school nurse, a school psychologist to handle the tremendous emotional trauma that children are living with in these times. You would expect to have a social worker to help with issues that kids are confronting out of school. You'd expect to have a library. You'd expect to have a librarian. You'd expect to have up-to-date technology. We're now going to be closing schools, and this is happening all over the country, sending kids home and say there'll be home instruction, but many kids don't have internet access, and they also don't have computers. So we have to spend, if we expect to have a future generation, we have to invest in our children. And this current Trump administration is cutting back on the SNAP program, which is a nutritional program is for kids in school. It's cutting, it's actually cut the budget, or proposes to cut the budget, of the Centers for Disease Control. And just yesterday, the administration insisted that it still wants to cut the budget of the Centers for Disease Control, as well as the budget of the National Institutes for Health. So we're in this crazy time where we have no leadership. And if you watched the president's speech last night, as I did, it was particularly distressing because he was focused on keeping people out of the country, shutting the borders to people coming from Europe. But the virus is here. We're not talking about a foreign virus. We're talking about something that's popping up in almost every state in the country and in communities where no one has come from China or any Asian country in the past, I don't know, 6 months or a year. And the virus is here, and the one thing that seems to be apparent is it is affecting children far less than older people. I mean, I'm in the highest risk group of all because I'm 81, and my lungs are compromised, and so I'm in a very bad position. But there are lots of other people who are getting it who are in their 20s and their 30s and their 40s and their 50s, and most of them will recover. But our hospitals are going to be strained. And we're closing down, basically closing down our economy. So it's a once in a century occurrence, and we have no leadership at the top. We're in we're treading in unknown waters with a man who only is concerned about his poll numbers.
Mm. Well, and the problem with children, I mean, it's of course we're so happy that children are not getting sick from the virus. In fact, I saw a couple of stories yesterday, and the scientists are still trying to figure out why that is. But children,
it's not entirely true because there have been a few children infected, but the numbers definitely favor young people as opposed to older people.
Right. In fact, according to a New Scientist, a recent study of about 44,000 people with confirmed infections found that children under 10 made up less than 1% of those cases and no deaths. But the problem that people are concerned about is that kids could have it and not know it. With all of us, this is the case, and we could give it to someone who's older or give it to someone whose immune system is compromised.
Right. Well, this virus, apparently, from what we're seeing, is highly contagious. It's spreading around the world, and we have seen a reaction from the right-wing media, like Rush Limbaugh, saying it's just the common cold. Mm. I mean, people need accurate public information. And there are scientists who are trying to put out accurate information, but they're putting out accurate information and being disregarded by the people at the highest levels of government, which is totally irresponsible.
So, Diane, what are your thoughts overall about how these decisions have been made? So far this morning, some schools in the Bay Area are closed. The Catholic schools are closed. A lot of private schools are closed, but many schools are not. What do you think about the decision-making process and how it's rolled out so far?
Well, I'd say that it has to be made on a school-by-school basis, which is right, but that the people those who decide to close the school have to do so making plans to make sure that children and their families are adequately protected. Some of those children and families will not have any food, because the only food that the children get is during the time they're in school. And if the children are sent home, their parents are not going to be able to work. And if they're not given any protection in terms of paid leave while they're home, they're not going to be able to pay their rent or buy food. So all of the consequences have to be anticipated when you close the school. And you have to protect children and you have to protect families. And you can't allow people to die simply because our government has not put out the test kits that are needed and made no plans for paid sick leave. The Democrats in the House of Representatives came out with a program this morning proposing free testing and massive testing. There are actually a few cities that are doing it on their own. I just saw last night that Colorado has a drive-by testing center where people literally can drive up in their car, be tested, and move on. But nationally, we're only testing like 10,000 people a day. No, we're not. We're testing. We have tested about 10,000 people throughout the entire nation up to this point. It's in South Korea where they're testing 10,000 people a day, not here.
Right.
So what needs to happen right now, as quickly as possible, is to have the testing done. The vaccine is pretty far off into the future, according to the highest level science officials who are still in the federal government. It will take anywhere from a year to a year and a half to have a vaccine. But the first thing we need is accurate information. And you can get that by going to the National Institutes of Health, by going to the Centers for Disease Control, and going to reputable scientific sources, and don't listen to Fox News or get your advice from Rush Limbaugh.
Today we're joined by Diane Ravitch, Research Professor of Education at New York University and the author of 10 books. Her latest is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane has worked on public education and in government for a very long time, so she really understands what is happening in our public schools. And according to Vox, 1.36 million students were homeless as of the 2016-2017 school year. 30 million students qualify for free or reduced price lunch at schools. And for families living in poverty, so many people say it makes it so difficult. What about the parents who don't have flexible schedules and cannot find adequate and affordable childcare? So if you're dealing with this, we'd love to hear from you. This also just really shows the inequities in our school system and brings up so many issues around class. So if you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Diane, you mentioned the bill that the Democrats have passed. NBC also reports that the USDA has approved waiver requests in Washington State, California, and Alaska to allow use of the Summer Food Service Program to serve free meals to low-income children affected by these closures. And so this basically means that kids can get meals from a designated site and then take it home so they don't have to eat off-site. But I don't know why this is the case. This cannot be a federal mandate. Each school has to apply for, or each state has to apply for this waiver.
Well, in general, the Trump administration has been trying to kick poor people off of any kind of programs to assist them at a time like this, and they've tried to reduce the number of students eligible to receive reduced or free lunches. So the Democrats haven't passed a bill yet. They actually proposed a bill, and they're in favor of a bill, to make all testing free. In New York right now, people have reported being asked to pay up to $600 or more for a corona test, and everyone should be tested who needs to be tested, and it should be free. And children, it should not be only three states that are eligible for students to get the lunches they need to survive, because that may be the only meal they get all day, given the fact that we have so many children who are homeless and so many children who are living in poor homes.
Right.
The equity here is protect the American people, and you cannot protect the American people if children and families are going hungry and homeless, and if they don't have access to testing for this virus and to protection against the virus.
Right, and thank you for that correction. There are so many moving parts here. The bill has not passed yet, but
right.
the Democrats
been proposed.
Right,
and from what I saw, Kevin McCarthy, who's one of your California congressmen and who's the leader of the Republicans in the Congress, has said there's no way they're going to pass this bill, which requires free testing for everybody for the coronavirus and a number of other things that would protect the health and well-being of the American people. Now, I would think that the people in his district would be calling him and saying, please reverse your position, Congressman McCarthy. This is ridiculous. This is us. We're your constituents. We need help.
Mm. To that point, Diane, there's so much misinformation or wrong information coming from the administration. Sarah Overmull is a Politico reporter, and she tweeted last night, Trump's claim tonight that health insurers have agreed to waive all copayments for the coronavirus treatment seems to be news to them, because according to the insurance lobby, AHIP, it's for testing, not for treatment. So we need to get an answer on what this actually means.
Well, there were many people tweeting last night, including some from within the administration, that his statement, his 11-minute statement was filled with errors, and that the insurers knew nothing about his pledge that co-payments would be waived. So you can't really say that anything the president said was accurate, because we know that he doesn't fact-check his speeches before he makes them, and that his speech was written by Jared Kushner and also by Stephen Miller. So Stephen Miller's primary interest is in keeping immigrants or anyone else out of the United States. But this is like saying, you know, there's a burglar in my house, and then having 911 tell you to lock your door. The burglar's already in the house. We're not worried about, we shouldn't be worried about closing the borders. I mean, I know the president believes that if we build the southern wall faster, that'll stop the coronavirus. But this is ridiculous, because there are very few cases of coronavirus reported in Mexico, and the virus is here. Building a wall is not going to change that.
Today we're speaking with Diane Ravitch, research professor of education at New York University, author of 10 books, including Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Schools. So we're just getting word that Ireland is going to close schools and colleges to halt the spread of this virus. Here in the United States, according to Education Week, as of yesterday, 621 K-12 schools have closed in response to the outbreak. A number of colleges are also going online. In fact, a number of colleges have asked students to leave the dorms as soon as they can. Diane, one of the doctors that spoke on one of Bernie Sanders' roundtables said that she doesn't expect the height of this crisis in the United States to hit for another few months. So how long? I mean, you don't know, but how long can this go on for?
Well, the fact is no one really knows. And I think that I would say that he's probably right, because it's more advanced than other countries. And the entire country of Italy is on lockdown right now, but it will continue to increase here. I've seen curves that show the increase, and we're just at the beginning of the increase. We're seeing these cases pop up in places that have not had any recent travelers. So it's been communicated from person to person, and many, many colleges have closed down. Many sporting events will now be played. If they're played at all, they'll be played to empty auditoriums or stadiums with no people in them. So it's all very strange, and we're basically seeing our economy shut down. This is a once-in-a-century happening, and it should not be underestimated. It should not. We don't need to have anyone say, "Don't worry, it's not a problem. It's under control." I think what frightens people is that it's not under control, and there's a sense that the people who know what to do are not in charge, and they're the people at the Centers for Disease Control and the people at the National Institutes for Health and the scientific community. And we've had 3 years of belittling science and belittling vaccines, and now we see we need them.
We have a message from Erica who says, "My daughter's school, Lakeshore, just closed, and I'm trying to distance organize food support and other resources for families. We're a Title I school. I'm also trying to figure out how our hourly staff will be paid. I'm rendered speechless at how this virus has highlighted the deep inequities in our city, state, country, and world. As usual, the already vulnerable, oppressed, and exploited will suffer the most."
Absolutely, because when schools are closed, there will be children without food. There will be families without food. There will be parents who have to stay home to take care of their children, who will have no protection and who are working in the gig economy, where if you don't work, you don't get paid, and they won't be able to pay their rent. So we're facing a crisis of equity, but also a health. I mean, this is not an economic crisis, although it is, but it's a health crisis, and it threatens us all. But we talked a little bit earlier about the Democratic legislation that was proposed, and I watched Pelosi this morning, and she said we don't need to wait 48 hours. We need to act right now to help families. And so what was included in the Democratic proposal was nutrition aid, assistance for the states for unemployment, for Medicaid costs, for unemployment assistance, for nutritional help, for food. And also for free testing. And the Republican response was, well, this is dead on arrival. So we really, all those people who do have Republican representatives should call them and say, tell them that this is a national crisis, and they should get on board and make it a bipartisan response to the crisis, and not simply say we don't want to fund the CDC, we don't want to fund food aid, we don't want to fund testing. I mean, this is insane.
Well, to Erica's point, and we just did a show about school workers, especially cafeteria workers. According to this piece in Vox, while public school teachers will likely still be paid if schools close, the picture is less clear for early childcare workers who make just $10.82 an hour on average, about a third of what elementary school teachers make.
Well, this is outrageous. I mean, frankly, I don't think anyone should work for less than $15 an hour, and the federal minimum is even less than what you described for the early childhood workers. These are people who will not have the money to pay for their rent or to pay for food or to pay for any necessary medicine. And I think that if we push our legislators, our congressmen, our senators, and I don't think California has a problem, although it has a problem with the fact that the House Minority Leader is Kevin McCarthy, and he's from California. Kevin McCarthy of California should be bombarded with emails saying this is a crisis, and we need medical protection, we need unemployment insurance, we need nutritional aid, we need testing, and we need it now, not a week from now or a month from now.
Diane, what other options do parents have if they cannot find childcare and the school is closed? I mean, what are you hearing out there from people?
Well, I know that in other communities, people are talking about finding one central source, like a church or someplace that's open. This is a real problem, is churches are closing. Right. All kinds of community activities are closing. And there has been a proposal, at least in New York, to have one school open in each area where families can go and collect meals. So this requires that somebody prepare the meals, and in some cases where people are homebound, they distribute the meals. But we have a national crisis, and we're going to have to come up with local solutions because there's no leadership from the top.
Today we are speaking with Diane Ravitch, author of 10 books, including Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. Diane Ravitch is a research professor of education at New York University. In about 10 minutes, we will be joined by a scientist to take your questions about the virus, but we decided to start today's show off with Diane to talk about the many inequities and questions surrounding school closures. Many districts across the country are closing their schools. Vox has a good article about struggles with childcare, and according to Education Week, as of yesterday, 621 K-12 schools around the country have closed in response to this outbreak. There's just so many questions because a lot of children, up to 30 million, rely on free or reduced lunches at school. For many, it's their only hot meal. And so many families in this country live in poverty. And for many of them, it's also where they get health care. In the case of New York, and I'm sure other areas, it's where they wash their clothes. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with Diane Ravitch right after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar, and today we're joined by Diane Ravitch, research professor of education at New York University, the author of 10 books. Her latest is Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools. And if you have any questions for Diane, she'll be on with us for about 10 more minutes, and then we'll open up the lines to take your questions about the virus. But if you have any questions about education, comments, if your child if their school is closed, if you're curious about whether it will be closed and what your plan will be, and then just the bigger question about what this really says about our public school system, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Diane, David Perry, a senior academic advisor to the History Department at the University of Minnesota, had a piece in the Washington Post. And it's called How to Close Colleges Without Hurting Vulnerable Students. When schools like Harvard and Amherst shut down over coronavirus fears, they may be leaving students homeless. So I've seen this a lot on social media. A lot of people said, if you shut down my dorm, I have nowhere to go.
Well, that's a problem that we have no one to deal with. I think that this coronavirus crisis shows the necessity, the importance of having a strong public sector where there can be a coordinated effort to reach out to develop capacity for housing students who are made temporarily homeless or permanently homeless, and also for dealing with family. We have many thousands of children and families that are already homeless without the coronavirus. That's going to get worse as more and more people find they can't pay their rent. And that's why it's so crucial that we have a public sector that can act. And so I would really urge everyone to look at the proposal that Pelosi and the Congressional Democrats came up with, which is reasonable, sensible. It addresses providing free access to testing for millions of people, expanding paid sick leave, providing food assistance for needy families. And all the Republicans have spoken out against it. Kevin McCarthy of California said that the Democratic proposal comes up short, and he said it would just create a bureaucracy. Mitch McConnell in the Senate said this will create a bureaucracy. And Trump said it doesn't include the payroll tax cut. It just has what Democrats want. And so Democrats are trying to slip across these programs like feeding hungry people instead of giving tax cuts, which he prefers. Mm. So, you know, here we have a government that is literally paralyzed, where there's no leadership, and the only thing that the president can think of is tax cuts and rate cuts, because he thinks he's dealing with an economic problem rather than a health crisis.
Diane, California Governor Ro Khanna questioned people about the virus. And in one of his questions, he pointed out that the annual Pentagon budget is $738 billion. I had to make sure I had that right because there are so many zeros. $738 billion, while the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is 1.5% the size.
And the Trump administration has proposed cutting the Centers for Disease Control, and yesterday when asked about this cut, they stood by it and said the coronavirus was not a reason to restore the budget cut. Mm. And I think that the Democrats in the House will block the budget cut because this is insane.
Well, I also just want to point out, it's really important to remember that even these wealthy colleges, David Perry in the Washington Post points out, yes, Amherst is rich, but that does not mean that the students are rich. 56% receive aid, and many have to take out additional loans. And he said even something as simple to some people as a plane ticket to go back home is out of reach for a lot of students.
Well, I think that in the case of Amherst or other colleges that have dormitories that are going to be emptied out, they might be wise to reconsider and allow students to live on campus and not then go to classes, because the classes will be online, but they could use the online facilities on campus. They could practice social distancing, which is to stay 6 feet away from every other human being. And they could, you know, know that they have food and that they have a place to live. Those campuses are going to become ghost towns, and the students have been told that they have to get out, and they're told that they have a week or 2 weeks or even less to get out. And so there will be empty campuses, empty dormitories, and kids sleeping on the streets.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to John in Oakland. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was wondering how this crisis will play out for the school privatization folks. How are they going to spin this?
Can you be more specific? What do you mean exactly?
Well, I mean, is this going to provide fuel for the privatization movement, or are they going to be able to take advantage of it to get rid of public schools, or what?
All right, thank you, Diane. What are your thoughts?
Well, I appreciate the question, which brings us back to the subject of my book. There are several different ways in which privatization is moving apace. In California, it's been an incredibly vigorous charter school movement. Thus far, you don't have vouchers, although that issue will come back again. But the charter school movement has a very powerful lobby in Sacramento. They've had to give a bit ever since Gavin Newsom became governor. Jerry Brown was a huge supporter of charter schools. The other form of privatization is the online virtual schools, and California has the California Virtual Academy, which is one of the worst schools in the state, probably the worst school in the state, because these virtual academies are, in almost every state, the worst school, because the heart of learning is interacting with a human being. And so I think you'll see a lot of these companies moving in to take advantage of the crisis to say, oh, great, stay home and use my technology. We need to buy more iPads. We need to buy more Chromebooks. We need to buy more of software, hardware. And so for the tech industry, this crisis is being seen as an opportunity. And I've seen the quote many times from Rahm Emanuel, never let a good crisis go to waste. And so the edtech industry will move in quickly to say, use what we're selling, and we'll sell even more. So this is a profit opportunity for them. And it will be used increasingly to say we don't actually need to have brick-and-mortar schools. The problem with that, as I said at the beginning of my comments, is the virtual charter schools are the worst schools in the country because kids ultimately get very bored with being online unless they're playing games. But for learning purposes, virtual education doesn't work. It's a huge money maker, and it simply is educationally very, very limited.
Well, Diane, thank you so much for joining us. And as I said, we would love to have you back soon to talk about your book.
That would be wonderful. Thank you. And good luck helping to steer us through these perilous times.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for your work. Diane Ravitch.
Thank you.
Diane Ravitch is a research professor of education at New York University and the author of 10 books, including Slaying Goliath, The Passionate Resistance to Privatization and the Fight to Save America's Public Schools, and will continue to focus on this aspect of the coronavirus outbreak, all of the schools and colleges closing, and the questions and inequities that come up as a result. Now I would like to welcome Dr. Aubrey Gordon to the show. Dr. Gordon is professor of public health at the University of Michigan. Her research interests are the areas of infectious disease, epidemiology, and global health. Hi, Dr. Gordon. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, happy to. How are you?
Well, we're trying to get people as much information as we can without causing panic, but it is really serious. I want to ask you about a piece I just read in Bloomberg this morning by Claire Che, and I just want to read this to you and then get your response. Patients with the new coronavirus keep the pathogen in their respiratory tract for as long as 37 days, according to a new study. Doctors in China detected the virus's NRA in respiratory samples from survivors for a median of 20 days after they became infected, and they wrote an article that was published in the Lancet Medical Journal. What are your thoughts on this?
I haven't read that article yet, but I do know that some people have tested positive, quite a while after they were thought to have recovered. I have heard it's definitely concerning, and I think we need to do a little bit more research in that area, which will consist of continuing to test people out after they seem to have recovered from illness, to figure out how long people continue to shed the virus and if the virus is viable so that we can figure out appropriate timelines for how long people should isolate themselves.
Right. Then the other question, and this is related, BuzzFeed has a piece, and they're reporting that the virus appears able to linger in the air for up to 3 hours and on plastic and stainless steel surfaces for 2 to 3 days. This is according to lab tests run by a team of federal and academic scientists in the United States.
Yeah, so I have read that paper. I have seen that, and indeed, they looked at not only RNA, but they looked at being able to grow the virus from those samples. And so it does appear that is the case, that it can exist in the environment sometimes for a prolonged period of time, depending on the surface.
So I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about the message we should tell our circle of friends, family, and colleagues, Dr. Gordon? Because on social media, I'm seeing a lot of people still say things like, I'm still going to live concerts if they're still taking place. I'm still going about my day because I'm young and healthy. I mean, I just saw comments like that last night.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've seen a lot of people, you know, kind of feeling that way, or because they feel like, well, yeah, but it's, you know, I don't know anybody with coronavirus, or, you know, there haven't been that many people that have tested positive wherever, so it should be okay. You know, I think our testing is very limited. We know that this is a very severe virus. It's certainly more severe in older individuals and people with comorbidities, but it's severe for everybody, and we all have a social, it doesn't seem severe for children, but for adults across the ages, it seems relatively severe. And we all have a social responsibility to take care of our population, and particularly the more vulnerable members. So I would highly recommend that people think carefully about whether they really need to go out and do those things like going to concerts or going to movie theaters. You should think carefully about any travel that you're doing right now. And I would limit non-essential travel. I think we all have a responsibility to try to reduce transmission of this virus to make sure that the health systems do not become overwhelmed.
Dr. Gordon, I'm wondering, what are you learning from places like Italy? I mean, it's just been heartbreaking to watch what's happening in Italy. In fact, the BBC News just sent out a breaking alert that coronavirus deaths have risen to over 1,000 in Italy. And a lot of people, doctors, people who live there, are putting messages out on Facebook saying, please learn from us and don't make the same mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, it is incredibly upsetting what's happening in Italy, but I would stress that that could happen anywhere that has a large outbreak of this virus. You know, in Italy, I understand where the government was coming from and their initial reluctance to limit movement. I think they hoped that they could control the virus without putting in significant limitations on civil liberties, and then they had this kind of stepwise progression when things started to, you know, it started to become clear in some setting, in some cities or villages, that there were large outbreaks or relatively large outbreaks. They limited those villages. Some people did not take that very seriously, and clearly it was already transmitting in other areas of northern Italy as well. They then limited movement around northern Italy, but at that point the medical system was really starting to become overwhelmed, and then they had to, you know, kind of lock down the entire country to try to make sure that there are areas of the country, ideally, that can help the areas that are facing extremely large outbreaks.
We have some useful information for people in San Francisco. Thank you for this, Rob. If you want to get updates from the city and county of San Francisco about COVID-19, just text COVID-19SF to 888-777. Again, that's COVID, COVID, 19SF, all one word, to 888-777. Thank you so much for that, Rob. And let's take a caller. Let's go to Elizabeth in Oakland. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. Thank you so much. I'm so curious to know when you say, when you're told to either wear gloves or cough into your clothing, does that remain on clothing for any length of time? Does the virus remain on any of the clothing or fabrics?
So it could remain for a little while. The main thing about clothing, it's a porous surface. And so the virus, if it dries out, the virus is not going to survive very long on a porous surface. However, certainly wet cloth that we'll say is wet with respiratory secretions, it could stay on that cloth for a little while. However, if you cough into your elbow, you are not usually touching that cloth from the inside of your elbow onto items.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. We have an email from Sadiqa who says, if someone infected but with symptoms prepares food raw or cooked, can they transmit the virus to people who eat it? I assume whether it's raw or cooked would make a difference.
You know, so we don't think that that is how this virus transmits. So I would be less concerned about the food and more concerned about the plate or utensils or other items, those kinds of items that people had touched.
And then one more. If I drop something on the floor in a public place, like car's wallet or purse, does it need to be disinfected before it can be used safely?
I guess it depends on where the public place is. I would be careful in if it was in a hospital setting or, if you're in an ER. But generally speaking, no, I do not believe that should be a problem. You shouldn't get transfer at that point.
Okay. Thank you for those questions. Ruby asks, why are we not being told to wear gloves?
The thing is, you would just get the viruses onto the gloves, right? So you would touch something that has the virus, and then you still may touch your face with the gloves. The virus may actually survive for more time on a glove, which is a non-porous surface, than your hands.
And then another everyday question, Kathy says, what about keypads in public places? She says, I'm trying to use hand sanitizer after putting in PIN codes, but I have not heard this addressed, even though we use these screens on a regular basis out in public.
Certainly those screens, I would say, are a concern.
Okay.
And so you would want to try to wash your hands or use hand sanitizer afterwards. If you're not using your knuckles to rub your eyes, you could also do it with a knuckle if you're concerned that you're not going to be able to wash your hands right away.
Today we're speaking with Dr. Aubrey Gordon, a professor of public health at the University of Michigan, and her research interests are the areas of infectious disease epidemiology and global health. And we're going to spend every day taking a chunk of the show to really bring you information that you need and give you the latest updates. And just open the lines for any questions you might have. So if you have any questions for Dr. Gordon, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And at this point, the state of Washington has canceled all events with 250 or more people. California Governor Gavin Newsom says the same thing should apply in California. Over 250 people. Dr. Gordon, at this point, what other questions still need to be answered?
For coronavirus?
Yes.
I think, one big question that we have as far as controlling transmission is understanding what role children may or may not take in transmission. We know that children are a little bit less susceptible. So there's a lot of talk about school closures. I think, particularly in areas of outbreaks, school closures probably make sense at this point, given that we don't know the role of children.
Right, and we actually just talked about that with a public education expert, Diane Ravitch. We have another very basic question. Does mouthwash help to stop spreading the virus when you cough or sneeze?
Not to my knowledge.
How easy is it to pass this on? Right now, there's the distance rule. Try to keep a distance from people. But can you talk about just how easy it is? If I have it right now, I don't know I have it. And I'm still at work. Our producers are staying home. But, once I go talk to my colleagues, how easy would it be for me to pass it on?
So we think the primary mode of transmission is through droplet transmission. So droplets would be those kind of larger droplets, like particles that you produce when you cough or you sneeze, or you can even produce when talking. And those tend to fall out of the air within 6 feet from you. And so that's why they're saying to keep a little bit of distance, try to keep 6 feet away from other people. The other way that we think it's probably being transmitted is through either direct contact with somebody else's hands, for example, or indirect contact. So I touch a keyboard, and then you come up right behind me and touch that same keyboard, and then you touch your face.
Right. So six feet distancing is really key, if possible. I mean, for a lot of people, they can't do that because they have to go to work and make a living. We have another caller who says, if everyone in the world could stay home for 2 weeks, could we contain this the right way?
I think we'd have to all stay home for longer than 2 weeks to make sure it was completely contained. Mm-hmm. But certainly if everybody stayed home for a few weeks, that would cut down on transmission, although you might get household transmission. And then And then you would have to be able to still carefully track cases and test people to determine who was infected. You can see that in Wuhan, right? It wasn't a 2-week closure that was necessary to bring those numbers down. It's been significantly longer.
And another listener says, a little less hysteria. Well, we're not trying to spread hysteria. We just want to get people the information they need, but I'm sorry if you feel that way. This listener writes, if you have recovered from the virus, how do you keep on infecting people for weeks?
So sometimes you can recover from respiratory viruses and still shed them for quite a while. So the symptoms are over, but you've got that virus. I don't know that we know, and I haven't looked at that paper that you referred to, how common that is with COVID. So I think we definitely need to look into that to figure that out.
Right. Well, Dr. Gordon, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for all the information.
Absolutely. Take care.
Dr. Aubrey Gordon is professor of public health at the University of Michigan. And if you're just tuning in, this study that she mentioned that I cited, I found it on Bloomberg. And this is a study coming out of China, and they have found that patients with the virus can keep the pathogen in their respiratory tract for as long as 37 days. Dr. Gordon said she's not familiar with the study and more testing needs to be done. So we will continue to bring you as many updates as possible. And again, if you do have questions and we have not answered them yet, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.